Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go.
Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to the Saturday Frights podcast. Now, I want you all to be setting down for this big announcement. I need you listeners to be ready for what I'm about to say. The projectionist is here.
Ooh, very droll, Victor.
Yes, after his month-long absence, our friend has returned to the control booth of the Retroist Vault. So, if you don't mind me putting you on the spot, just where have you been these last few weeks, man? You didn't show up for any of the Retro Radio Memories episodes. No explanation. Barely any communication on Facebook.
You really are quite excitable at times, Sage. I have been making preparations.
For what?
For a worst-case scenario. For what I hope will not come to pass. But I fear must.
Way to be vague and ominous there. You want to expand on that just a bit?
Not particularly.
Well, for whatever reason, it really is good to have you back. I've missed you, my friend.
Pshaw. Such sentiments. Trifling, melodramatic, if you ask me.
You do seem a little tense. I mean, more than usual.
You do not live as long as I have without learning to trust your instincts. And I'm afraid something bad is coming.
It's the holidays, projectionist. What is the worst that could happen?
Do you not remember this time last year? Rampaging Krampus attack?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a very special podcast, friends. It marks our 50th episode, and so...
The 50th broadcast? My, how the time does fly.
I know. I can't believe we hit this mark myself. I want to thank each and every one of you, our listeners, for keeping us going. Those Facebook messages and emails really do mean a lot, as well as sharing the podcast with your friends. The community we've all built to celebrate horror films is incredible. So, from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you again for accepting our little show.
Well said, Victor. I think the fact the listeners have tolerated you so long as host speaks volumes.
Moving on. Being the 50th episode, we've decided to tackle George A. Romero and Stephen King's 1982 cinematic ode to those classic EC comics of old, like Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, and The Haunt of Fear, with Creepshow.
This is a particular film that has long been on the back burner, eh?
That is quite true, projectionist. I was always worried about sliding a particular segment of the film. I mean, how do you keep things under 30 minutes when talking about an anthology film?
I would suggest you make an attempt to keep your synopsis below 40 minutes. But that is just me.
Yeah. It was Stevie, our new intern at the Retroist Vault, who came up with the simple solution of splitting the film into its 5 separate segments.
I thought I smelled Stevie's stench here in the control room. It doesn't look like he took the trash out.
He was actually dropping off a package for you. It's over there on the desk. And about the trash, you know we can just dump it ourselves, right? I mean, the recycling center is just one level down from this control room.
Nonsense. Besides, it makes him happy to be so useful. Dear listeners, I wish you could see how giddy he gets, almost like a kid in a candy store when asked to perform such duties.
You know, the Retroist Industries HR department is going to come after you one of these days.
I would like to see them try.
So listeners, for the next 5 days, we will have a new Saturday Frights podcast episode for your listening enjoyment. On today's episode, we'll be focusing on not just the fantastic intro that sets up the tone of Creepshow, but the first story segment that is entitled Father's Day. We wouldn't normally devote such time to the intro, but to be fair, its story arc is kind of a sixth segment for the movie.
I remember our audience at the Haunted Drive-In seemed to really get into the spirit of this film. It certainly celebrates the dark comedy of those early horror funny books, with not only the writing, but the lighting and color scheme of each of the segments. They do their best to turn certain scenes into a moving funny book image.
Very true. We can get into some of the technical stuff a bit later. Creepshow was released on May 16th, 1982. I saw this film at the 112 Drive-In on opening night with my father, and both of us being horror fans, we kinda ate it up. It also became a regular rental for my family when visiting our local video store. When Creepshow opens, we find ourselves outside of a house, and it must be in October as there's a cheerful jack-o'-lantern in the window.
It's such a shame that such a cheerful scene cannot be viewed within the house.
Yeah, a storm is starting to brew outside, but inside there is already a hurricane of parental outrage. In this case, a father who is angry with his young son for reading Creepshow, a horror comic. The father, who is named Stan, is played by the always awesome Tom Atkins. And his son, Billy, is none other than a young Joe Hill, the real-life son of Stephen and Tabitha King. Stephen King and George Romero had become friends by this point, which is why King wrote the screenplay for Creepshow. Projectionist, also in this scene, is Billy's mother, who is looking on in apprehension at her husband's wrath. Do you get the feeling that we the viewers are to believe this is a normal occurrence? That Stan maybe has a bit of a temper issue?
Most certainly. Little Billy's bedroom, we should point out to the listeners, is a veritable shrine to monster memorabilia, like the theatrical one sheet from Todd Browning's Dracula.
Agreed. I was a little envious of all the Godzilla toys we can see in that room, plus the Mega Hulk and other stuff. Billy has his blood up at being scolded and falsely accused, which causes him to start mouthing off.
Which earns the little scamp a hard slap across the face. Billy's mother is worried by this. Worried, of course, that the neighbors will hear all of this caterwauling, as she makes mention that the windows are open downstairs.
Well, I think she's just using that as an excuse to get Stan out of the room. Stan angrily says he'll take care of that after he throws Creepshow into the garbage, which he does, just in time before the storm arrives. And while Stan surely thinks it's part of his imagination, is that joyous? Sinister cackling on the winds? If there was any doubt about Stan's personality before, in a beautiful bit of writing by King, we get his thoughts on his actions, as well as a preview of what kind of stories we're going to see played out through the movie as he returns to the house.
That takes care of that.
Stan, don't you think you were a little hard on him?
You see that crap? All that horror crap? Things coming out of crates and eating people? Dead people coming back to life? People turning into weeds, for Christ's sake?
Well, yes, I did, but I...
Well, you want him reading that stuff?
Well, no, but...
All right, then. I took care of it. That's why God made fathers, babe. That's why God made fathers.
To be fair, listeners, when Stan mentions about taking care of the problem, he looks off into the distance. Maybe with just a tad of regret. And I think we are to understand his own father probably treated him just as roughly. I'm not excusing his behavior, of course, but just pointing out something I think the filmmakers wanted to clue us viewers in on.
Too bad for Stan that little Billy seems to be holding a grudge.
Indeed. We find Billy upstairs sitting on his bed, wishing a very dark fate for his father. And it seems a dark fate has decided to come a-calling. As the young boy looks through his bedroom window, as the storm arrives in all of its fury and sees the Creep, which is the skeletal host for the Creepshow comic, who is floating outside his window. The Creep begins to cackle, curling his skeletal fingers into a fist as Billy nods approvingly at the mayhem to come. But to learn what that is, you'll just have to wait until we discuss the end of the film in the filth episode for Creepshow. The Creep is an animatronic character, but the live-action format changes to animation for the film's title sequence, the Creep beckoning us to come with him outside and begin the film proper. We really should pause for a moment to make mention of the fantastic score by John Harrison. His Creepshow intro theme in particular is absolutely perfect. It, with the comic book images that fill the credit sequence, which are moments we will see in the movie, sell you on the mood of the film right away. As Father's Day begins, we are introduced to a colorful cast of characters that make up the wealthy Grantham clan. We have the elderly but stately Sylvia, played by Guiding Lights' Carrie Nye, Richard, who is portrayed by Warner Shook, and his sister, Cass Blaine, played by Elizabeth Reagan, with her husband Hank, played wonderfully by Ed Harris.
Rather a shock, I must admit, to see an actor of his caliber in what amounts to a bit part.
I kind of know what you mean, but remember that just a year earlier, Ed and Romero had worked together on the criminally overlooked Knight Riders.
That's right. The motorcycle film that retells the Arthurian legend.
I think you are oversimplifying the story there, projectionist. But back to Creepshow. These family members have all gathered to honor a current member of the clan that's not in attendance, their Aunt Bedelia. Or Great Anne in the case of Richard and Cass. Bedelia, who we are soon to meet, is an old biddy and is portrayed by the absolutely scene-stealing Vivacia Linford.
The Granthams are with a wealthy family, dear listeners.
Absolutely, projectionist. They are flush with old money, thanks to the talents of their deceased patriarch, Nathan Grantham.
You mean murdered patriarch, right, Victor? Nathan, as it is explained to a bewildered Hank Blaine, earned his money the hard way by being a bootlegger and dirty criminal.
You are right again, my friend. It was 7 years ago to the day, on Father's Day, that Nathan Grantham, with a continuous offering of verbal and possibly physical abuse against his own daughter Bedelia over the years, drove her to the brink of insanity, and she snapped.
Yes. While screaming for his Father's Day cake, slamming his oak cane against the arms of his chair, bellowing for Bedelia to bring him his cake. So, what is a woman like Bedelia to do?
The distraught woman rushes into the dining room, picking up a marble ashtray, and strikes her father down with all of her hatred.
The dear listeners might also wish to know that it was said Nathan had possessed an Oedipus complex in regards to his daughter. So much so that when she found love at long last with an older man, well, the family all believe that Nathan had the poor man done in during a hunting trip.
Yeah, Nathan was a piece of work. Of course, the whole family seems to be a bit odd. Oh, before I forget, the marble ashtray that Cass seems to enjoy handing to her husband and smiling at his discomfort. Yes, the very same ashtray used to kill Nathan can be seen in every segment of Creepshow. Just a fun little fact. being so wealthy, allowed the Grantham family to hush up the death so that on the county records, it was labeled an accident. It also cleared up any concern on Nathan's will, as the family members would equally share in his vast fortune. So, for the last 7 years, they've all gathered together to enjoy a baked ham and their good fortunes. Aunt Bedelia always joins the rest of her family after arriving at 6 p.m. sharp and spending about an hour visiting her father's grave, where she's overcome with grief at her actions.
Which we see her do, drinking heavily and explaining her said actions to her deceased father. But this Father's Day will be a little different, eh?
To say the least. For what it's worth, towards the end of her rant as she sits atop Nathan's grave, Vivisha really lets the mask of anger slip, replacing it with such a deep look of regret. I mean, she's of course playing a murderer, but I don't believe anyone will not find themselves feeling a little sorry for her in this scene.
I have heard it told that Vivisha lives, improvised the scene. She dredged up her relationship with her very own father, and that rage you mentioned was aimed at her ex-husband, George Tabori.
Wow. I guess we know now why it seems so real. Well, it seems that Nathan doesn't accept Bedelia's apology, as a decayed hand punches up through the graveyard dirt, bones shining whitely against the muck of the earth. Bedelia can only moan in fear as Nathan begins to pull himself out of his grave, and in an almost gargling and choked voice, demands one thing. The undead Nathan Grantham wraps his bony hands around his daughter's throat and slowly chokes the life from her, continually asking about his Father's Day cake, while worms and maggots crawl through the dirt caked in his mouth and eye sockets. And I have to say that Romero, who is quite known for his zombie films, really scared me with Father's Day. Well, there is one other segment, actually, that scared me even worse.
Victor, or Nathan is probably feeling left out and just wanted to join in on the family festivities.
Well, speaking of being scared, we cut back from the recently risen Nathan to find a truly frightening scene. Ed Harris, as Hank, is performing some kind of, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, he's dancing with Elizabeth Reagan, but it's just such a...
I think you're trying to say it looks like he might be experiencing a seizure of some kind, say.
Yeah, I guess that is the best way to describe it. It seems the hour has grown late, and while Richard is happy enough getting drunk, the loud music is growing on Aunt Sylvia's nerves. It's Hank who offers to go out into the night, to check out the family cemetery to make sure that Great Aunt Bedelia is okay.
Unfortunately for young Hank, he does find her.
Hank ends up tripping over the whiskey bottle that Bedelia dropped, and falls into Nathan's grave, which is where he meets the deceased older woman. As you might imagine, this rather scares the young man, but when he attempts to pick himself up out of the grave, we see the heavy stone marker of Nathan Grantham begin to tip over. It seems to inch ever closer to that tipping point any time Hank attempts to move. The young man is trying to figure out how to get out of the grave without being squashed when he's introduced to Nathan Grantham himself. The zombie stands at the lip of the grave, and it appears he now has dark powers, as he raises his arms out, and the headstone plunges forward to crush the screaming young man and Bedelia's remains. With a hearty chuckle, Nathan makes his way to his old home.
Things are rapidly deteriorating within. Cass, like a sullen child, is angry because dinner isn't being served until Bedelia arrives. That'll be a long wait, eh? And of course, she's wondering why Hank hasn't returned.
It's Sylvia who offers to go look for the young man. And, projectionist, am I wrong, or does it kind of seem like she has intentions on trying to seduce him?
I believe you are correct. Or, at the very least, she's attempting to make her niece rather uncomfortable.
As Sylvia enters the kitchen, she senses something is amiss, as all the lights are turned out. Making her way cautiously out of the kitchen, she is startled when the corpse of the Grantham's maid, Mrs. Danvers, is pushed against the kitchen doors. Sylvia doesn't have long to be terrified, however, as Nathan quickly steps up, grabs the older woman by the head, and twists it completely around with a neck-shattering crack. A little more time passes, and we see that Cass is starting to get very frightened now, and her pleas to her brother finally seems to galvanize the drunken Richard, who agrees to go with her, at the very least to find another bottle of wine. Much like Sylvia, the two are concerned when they learn the lights in the kitchen and dining room aren't operational. That is when Nathan Grantham makes his appearance, pushing through the double doors of the kitchen, holding up a Father's Day cake of his own making, topped with a severed head of Sylvia, glowing candles merrily flickering in the darkness. Richard and Cass scream in mind-numbing terror at the scene as Nathan proudly proclaims he got his cake. That, my friends, is the synopsis for Father's Day.
I quite enjoyed the segment, Victor. It truly did seem to be a type of story one would read in the Tales from the Crypt funny books, mostly.
Why do you say mostly?
In the EC comics of old, the characters of Cass and Hank Blaine, as well as Richard Grantham, would not be punished alongside Sylvia Grantham, Mrs. Danvers, and Bedelia Grantham, as they were innocent in the act of the murder of Nathan Grantham, or at least covering it up.
I'm going to disagree with you on that one, projectionist. Partially. I think that Romero and King give us a pretty solid picture of the younger characters. They're in no way sorry for their great aunt's actions, in terms of Richard and Cass. I mean, they know the truth and haven't gone to the authorities. Hank is portrayed as maybe being a gold digger. So what I'm saying is that while no one deserves to be hunted down by a zombified relative, these people aren't upstanding citizens.
Perhaps you're right. I'm not sure if you picked up on this, Victor, but the comic book that is used in the film was drawn and inked by real-life veteran EC Comics artist Jack Kamen.
Really? I didn't know that, projectionist. I do know that the legendary Bernie Wrightson illustrated the graphic novel tie-in for the movie. Oh, I mentioned the worms and maggot when Nathan Grantham rises from his grave. It turns out some of them, not all of them, mind you, were just Rice Krispies.
Do you know why Nathan Grantham returned to a semi-state of living?
I always just assume it was the lucky, or in this case, unlucky number 7. That's how many years had passed since his murder.
I think not. If you recall, Bedelia drops her whiskey bottle, and its remaining contents are soaked up by the grave. Are you familiar with James Joyce's 1939 novel, Finnegan's Wake?
I'm afraid I'm not.
In the book, the character Finnegan dies from a fall and is brought to life when whiskey is splashed upon his corpse.
Interesting. I'm not sure if I agree that was what Romero and King were tipping their hats to. Father's Day was written for Creepshow. It's not an adaptation of a previous Stephen King story. Projectionist, you mentioned the elements used in the film make it appear more like a living comic book before we began the synopsis. If you haven't seen the film for yourself, what my co-host is referring to is the use of actual comic book-style transitions during the movie. Like when Sylvia is explaining the details of Aunt Bedelia to Hank. We get a literal comic panel pan down to Bedelia swerving all over the road as she's driving to the Grantham estate. Or how the segments will begin, as well as end, with a comic book frame, an actual slow dissolve from illustration to real life, etc. The angles that Romero used in the film also harken back to the framing style of those wonderful EC comics. Even the lighting, as my co-host already mentioned, is suitable for a horror comic. While not quite sticking to the color scheme that, say, Warren Beatty did in Dick Tracy, Romero uses bright red to express shock and terror, and blues and greens for moments in the film involving treachery and deceit, etc. Now, before we jump into the notable cast and crew, projectionist, do you have any vintage ads to share with the listeners?
Actually, I'm afraid I do not this time.
Oh. Well, George A. Romero has 20 directing credits to his name, with notable films such as the 1968 masterpiece Night of the Living Dead, and its 1978 sequel Dawn of the Dead, and 1985's Day of the Dead. He also directed the 1993 film adaptation of Stephen King's The Dark Half, as well as another overlooked movie, 2000's Bruiser. In 2005, he continued the Dead series with Land of the Dead, before sort of doing a reboot of the series in 2007 with Diary of the Dead and 2009's Survival of the Dead. He also was an executive producer for the Tales from the Dark Side television anthology series for 77 episodes. Stephen King, do I really need to cover his body of work? The guy is still delivering epic chills with his recently released short story collection entitled The Bazaar of Bad Dreams. And his book, 112263, is being produced by J.J. Abrams and released exclusively to Hulu, fittingly enough, on President's Day in 2016. Carrie Nye passed away in 2006, with 19 acting credits to her name. But that included, besides The Guiding Light, roles in 1973's TV movie Screaming Skull, in 1980's The Scarlet O'Hara War. Carrie's true calling, it would seem, was on stage, where she appeared in numerous shows for over four decades. She was also married to the legendary Dick Cavett from 1963 until her death. Vivica Lindfors passed away back in 1995, but had earned 144 acting credits, with notable roles in film and television such as 1948's The Adventures of Don Juan, where she co-starred with Errol Flynn, 1973's The Way We Were, with Robert Redford and Barbra Streisand, and in one of her last roles, she portrayed Catherine Langford in the 1994 action sci-fi film Stargate. Elizabeth Reagan, well, this is her only role, actually. I'm not sure what happened to her. Warner Shook has three acting credits to his name, with them all being in George Romero productions. 1978's Dawn of the Dead, where he plays a zombie security guard. 1981's Knight Rider as Pippin, and of course, 1982's Creepshow. He did, however, go on to direct three episodes from Tales from the Dark Side, as well as two episodes of another horror anthology TV series, 1989's Monsters. John Lormer, who played the role of the living Nathan Grantham, passed away in 1986 with 167 acting credits, which included notable roles in 1967's Batman TV series as Professor Dactyl, as well as 1975's Rooster Cogburn, and he was also seen in 1981's The Boogans. Ed Harris has 98 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in 1983's The Right Stuff as John Glenn, 1984's Swing Shift, where he co-starred with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell, 1989's The Abyss, 1992's Glengarry Glen Ross, 1993's film adaptation of Stephen King's Needful Things, 1995's Apollo 13, 2005's History of Violence, and 2008's Appaloosa, one of my top five favorite westerns of all time. Next year, we're going to see him play the role of the Man in Black in HBO's 2016 remake of Westworld. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best and frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our new ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
I'm sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist Haunted Drive-In, which I'm proud to say has more friend requests than you, Sage.
We do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is, of course, available on iTunes and Stitcher. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. when you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until tomorrow, the vault is sealed.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.